Welcome to Wonk, a podcast about big ideas in unprecedented times, brought to you by the Public Policy Forum. I'm your host, Amanda Lang.
I think it is important for Canada to increase its ability to dictate its own future, and space is a part of that.
A Toronto-based startup recently launched 10 low-Earth orbit satellites. It was a big milestone for that startup, hoping to create a commercial satellite network. Meanwhile, a Canadian astronaut is poised to be one of the first to orbit the moon, and new investments are being made in space technology in this country. Chris Hadfield is one of Canada's best-known astronauts, the first Canadian to walk in space, commander of the International Space Station, an engineer, former fighter pilot, a musician, and now a best-selling author multiple times who has a new book. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Lots going on. Glad to be talking with you, Amanda.
Plenty going on. And I know you are actually speaking for Kepler. So I wanted to start there because this is a Canadian-based company. It's new technology. This is important to them. Just explain why it's important to the rest of us.
It's a great story. Canadian company, as you mentioned, and just very recently launched 10 big satellites into orbit. The largest launch of Canadian satellites ever, 10 of them all at once. Each one of them is like 300 kilograms. And what they provide is laser communications in orbit, which is brand new kind of technology to be able to do that. And if you've got 10 of them, then they can all be communicating with each other and with the ground. So it's like we are moving the web to orbit. It's like we're moving the data centers to orbit now, and that Canada is doing it independently, completely homegrown, just a company called Kepler in Toronto here. The company was born here about a decade ago. It's already got 20-odd satellites up. But boy, this latest launch really sets the stage for the future of independent Canadian commercial activity in orbit.
And as I understand, because it's, and again, we got to be really careful not to take me out of my depth real fast, but it's optical technology, it's real time. So there's no latency. And that with other space communication, you actually have to wait to reach a place where you can transmit down to Earth. But this will happen in real time. How do you see the first applications rolling out because of that fact? That's a pretty important change.
Yeah, think what it used to be with the internet, right? You would dial in and you'd get logged in somehow and you'd send packets back and forth. But this is at the speed of light, real-time communication all around the world amongst the satellites. And it's optical, it's lasers, it's not like radio waves. So it can be very high data rate. And because there are 10 satellites, at least one of them always is over a site on Earth where they can be downlinking information, either radio waves or with lasers. So it's as if suddenly we have extremely high speed, extremely high data rate capability for a constellation around the world. And this is independent of other countries' constellations like that. So that's a big deal. And we already have a bunch of customers either already on board or lining up to be on board for this constellation that Kepler just put up, including for human spaceflight. One of the follow-on space stations is already committed to using the Kepler web on orbit. But even things like, what if a little satellite up there detects the symptoms of a wildfire on Earth? Well, what would happen right now is it would detect it and it would record it in its little memory. Then it would boop around the world until finally it came over some antenna on the world. And then it would try and downlink the information. Well, now those can be connected with our constellation real time. And you can get all that type of data. It's as if you took all the sensors now and are being able to put them together and giving them in a position where people can use them real time. So it's a big step, and I'm super proud that it's a Canadian step.
Most Canadians will know we have a bit of a legacy in space technology. We're very proud of the Canadarm and some other things, of course. But we definitely have fallen off in terms of where we rank and its importance to us as well. Do you see a change in that? Has that shifted a little bit? Is that why we're seeing companies like Kepler?
I think the big change is the cost of launch has plummeted. It used to be really rare and special and like a superpower thing to be able to launch a rocket. Well, the technology, like everything else, has progressed. So the cost has come down. So now there's a lot more things that can be launched to orbit just by independent companies. And it's taken a little while for Canada to take advantage of that and to be in a position to really start using that capability. Kepler's leading the pack. And this step here is the most significant one so far in Canadian industry, Canadian commercial spaceflight. We've done, as you say, some amazing things. You know, we were the third nation on Earth to have a satellite up there, and we've used it to communicate with big satellites stuck way out. So we, you know, the Canucks fans could watch the Leafs play real time, coast to coast. But this is a big step forward just in raw capability. It's like a community getting, you know, high-speed internet for the first time, and it leads to a lot more things. So we're really looking at sort of a bellwether of what's coming.
You know, we hear this term space sovereignty kicked around, and I'm curious to know what you think that means, or what we should, what you would say we should think it means. What are we talking about when we say space sovereignty?
Well, I mean, sovereignty is being able to protect the things that are under your purview. You know, each country has an area that they consider sovereign to themselves. And do you have the ability to protect your own borders, to defend your own way of life, your own culture, your own people, your own history? That's kind of a two-dimensional thing, right? When you think about it, territory. But with airplanes, then you have some airspace above it, and you're sovereign up to, you know, by our rules, about 60,000 feet. But above that, how does sovereignty even get defined and enforced? And so what really happens is your assets that are in orbit, whether you've put the Canadarm up there or satellites like Kepler just put up, then can you protect them? They're part of Canada's industry and Canada's capability. And how do we make sure that they are safe, just like everything on Earth? It's kind of a whole new area being hastened along by the drop in cost of launch. And so the government, the military, the Department of National Defense, and our sort of space command underneath that, they're thinking really hard about that right now, and thinking one of the things we truly need to stay sovereign is not to be counting on other countries for any critical piece of it, including launch. So that's a big shift in thinking, and it's happening right now also.
Which is something else, right, Canada? We do have a Canadian company that's working on a launch program as well. So although there are these kind of commercial programs, certainly in the U.S., I guess we can thank Elon Musk for that, but others, we will also do it increasingly from here, and that matters?
Absolutely, it matters. You can't always count on every country in the world to be hostile or to be friendly. You know, countries have their own individual agendas and changes of leadership. But look what's going on in Iran right now. Look what's going on in the United States right now. You know, things change. And if we are too beholden to one individual country, then we're vulnerable. So it's not just in space, obviously, but that's a pretty important domain right now. We count on it every single day. We're for so many things you don't even think about. Navigation, think about GPS, telecommunication. It's so easy to talk to each other. Banking, weather forecasting, wildfire detection, all kinds of stuff. So I think it is important for Canada to increase its ability to dictate its own future. And space is a part of that. And I'm really pleased to see the attention that that's getting within the decision makers, both political and commercial. And that means like investment as well.
Obviously, the space race began rooted in competition, right? It was the U.S. versus Russia. That was pretty clear, the Soviet Union. It then became one of cooperation, right, where we were working together, and that was an important part of it. Do you see that continuing? Because that kind of spirit of cooperation led us to, I don't want to say there's no rules, but to a place where it's hard to say who governs what gets put into space and how long it stays there. And are they looking after it if it becomes junk, you know, just kind of floats around up there for who's in charge, I guess, is the thing. Have we let that kind of spirit of cooperation turn into something where it's a bit lawless?
Well, technology always leads regulation. You know, we're way more inventive than we are, you know, worried about crossing the T's and dotting the I's and putting all the laws in place. Think of when cars were first invented. Henry Ford was cranking out Model T's in 1915. There weren't driver's licenses or stoplights or gas stations or good roads or anything, but the technology was so good that people wanted it. And then regulation had to catch up. Same thing with airplanes. And now you can go to I don't know, Vancouver, Toronto Airport, get on an airplane and pretty much go anywhere in the world and hardly have to worry about it. And that took an enormous amount of regulation to backfill the technology that allows it. That's just happening in space right now. The drop in cost of launch is opening space like it's like 1915 with cars or 1920 with airlines. And now we've got to figure out, how do we regulate this properly? How do we keep ourselves from making stupid long-term mistakes? And we're doing it. You know, we're every satellite has to be able to maneuver so it doesn't hit another satellite. It has a fixed amount of life that it can stay up there so it doesn't just add to a debris field. There's a big existing problem, just like on Earth. And I think really what we ought to do is the people that regulate airspace up to 60,000 feet globally and do such a great job under the United Nations, to me, it would make sense to extend that sort of responsibility and just take it up to 600 kilometers or 1,000 kilometers or something. We need some sort of overarching regulatory authority that everybody realizes, yeah, this may not be super convenient for my country, but overall, it's the best thing we should have. I think that's where we need to get to. But it's never easy, and it's much more fun just to invent and launch new stuff. But we're getting there, and we've done it in the past. I'm confident we'll figure it out again.
You know, one thing that does seem for sure true is that our attitude around this sector is improving. And I say that, you know, with great respect to those of you who have spent your whole life doing it. But, you know, Canada has not spent as much money on the space sector as it once did. We're way below even a decade ago. It's the percentage decline is shameful. But even compared to other countries, and I want to actually throw this at you, because we're the lowest of the OECD countries on the percentage of our GDP that we spend on space. But France, which is one of the highest, I assume the US is higher than France, but France was highest on the list I saw. It's still less than 0.1% of their GDP. That's the highest. So nobody's really spending a great deal on this. What would it look like if our government actually said, this is a sector with massive positive spin-off benefits and we're going to invest? God, imagine if it was 1% of GDP, it would be a huge number and it would be a huge boost to the sector.
Well, it's always a tug of war. I mean, number one, you got to take care of Canadians and Canada. That's the health and welfare of Canada. So for every, whatever, $1,000 the federal and all the provincial and municipal governments spend, how much do they spend on health and welfare of the people? And then how much do you spend on research and development and projects that aren't going to pay off right now, but are going to help make the whole economy successful a year or two from now? And there is a revolution happening in spaceflight, mostly driven by digital computing, artificial intelligence, making decision-making small and light and not just human. And then the other, of course, is decreasing the cost of launch. That revolution is changing spaceflight, access to space, and then all the money that's going to be made in all of the infrastructure that gets built in Earth orbit. And then as we move further out, like you mentioned at the start, a Canadian going to the moon here, fairly soon. So what is Canada's role going to be in that? How much should we spend? We've got to have those hard decisions. And you're right. I don't think we've spent enough, but wait for it. You know, there's a real redefinition of sovereignty happening right now with American policy, and that affects Canada more than any other country. And therefore, we need to really think carefully, not just about defense and sovereignty, but also about economic opportunity for Canada. And I'm heartened to read the early versions of the defense industrial strategy, looking at what incubators like the Creative Destruction Lab are working on and what companies like Kepler are already accomplishing. Those are all good indicators. We still got a long ways to go, but I think we're probably on a better path than we've been.
It sure feels like it. You mentioned Jeremy Hansen, who will go, I think, sometime in February, if all goes well. And I know you're playing a role in that. Just on a personal note, I have to ask you, as you get close to a mission like that, how does that feel to be on the ground? You know, you've done it before, but, you know, as somebody who's been there and done it and gone through it all and been on the other side of this equation, what's that like?
Space launches are super exciting and super dangerous. The rocket that Jeremy and his crew are flying, no human has ever flown that rocket before. And in fact, it's only flown once with nobody on board. So it's a brand new, incredibly complex and powerful machine. And that has a huge risk. So when you're watching, and especially where I'm going to be like there with family and extended family, I'll probably be there with Jeremy's mom and dad. that's nerve-wracking. And you've got to have a whole good plan in place in case the awful happens and things go wrong. Luckily, I've been a family escort, and other people have escorted my family multiple times. So it's an important and necessary role that I'm used to. When I'm standing there watching a launch, I'm so involved in it, but I'm also kind of helpless, and my fists are clenching and unclenching because I can't really do anything else as I'm just trying to, through force of will, to help that vehicle do what it's supposed to do and get the crew safely to orbit. And we're confident it's going to be okay, but it's still complicated, but it's just overpoweringly exciting. And it's really worth noting for Canada, no human being has ever left Earth orbit except Americans. It's never happened. No Soviet, no Russian, no Chinese, no Indian, no other nation. And the fact that because of 60 years of cooperation, Canada is now trusted and able to have the very first non-American leave Earth orbit and go to the moon, it's a real proof of good Canadian policy over the decades and proof of the good quality of people that we provide. And Jeremy Hansen is an outstanding example of that through the Canadian Space Agency and the Canadian Air Force. So yeah, I'll have all those emotions boiling inside me watching the rocket light and Jeremy leave Earth.
These kinds of events are, as you say, awesome in the true sense of the word, right? They're exciting. They're terrifying. When you think about where we should put our focus and our attention, what do you see as kind of the important next frontier? I mean, you have people, we have the kind of the Bezos and Musk view that it's, you know, Mars, it's actually some other kind of planet. You have people who think we should be mining in space, that there's all that kind of rare earth elements out there that we get our hands on. What's your view of kind of where the right focus is?
It's got to be incremental. You know, when I'm trying to figure out the future, I look at the past. You know, when we were first developing ships that for the very first time in the 1400s could sail around Africa and access the Indian Ocean, or start in 1492 crossing the Atlantic, or, you know, all those times in history, then what do you do with that new technology? And then how do you help it support the people at home and give them capability that they need? When we start to settle a new continent, sometimes we've done it pretty horribly, and sometimes we've done it pretty well. And our typical pattern is not to think very far in the future. But the way that we settled Antarctica is different than how we have left where we were and moved to a new continent and started settling there. And so how we settle the moon over the next generation, because now our technology is good enough, is sort of setting the precedent. We have lived on the space station peacefully and productively for 25 years. So we kind of left Earth 25 years ago and live by a different set of laws as we start to explore the rest of the solar system and the universe. And if we can extrapolate that, it's why I chair the Open Lunar Foundation, looking at those policies. It's an international group just looking purely at how it is that we should settle the moon. And I think it would be kind of regrettable if we just took kind of a transplant of our current geopolitical mess and just pasted that willy-nilly on the moon, if we can be a little more thoughtful in it, like we were in Antarctica. And Antarctica is not perfect, but at least it shows we can do different, because the moon is essentially a whole new uninhabited continent. It has no life, so we're not disrupting a biosphere or anything, and it has untold mineral riches. And if we can get there cost effectively enough, that's the next big step. Mars, you know, it's inspirational and cool, good to think about, but it's incredibly far away and really hard to get to. And it's very impractical at this point in the development of human technology. Eventually, we'll figure it out. But for now, space station, Earth orbit, moon, an Earth-moon economic system, that's where we are in the history of the human species right now. And once we get that sorted out, our technology will get better and we'll be able to start going across the huge ocean between here and Mars. It's a pretty exciting time right now, actually, and especially since Canada is so much in the thick of it.
It really is. And when you talk about that, the sort of the idea of kind of colonizing the moon, populating the moon, I wonder what the sort of obvious economic benefits are. And it doesn't have to have an economic benefit, but so far, the science that we've developed to do these things, to explore near space, to get to the moon, have had huge economic benefits, right? And benefits for humanity. The internet is one example. Do you see that continuing? In other words, the externalities of that push, or have we kind of reached the limit of the benefits and technology we'll get, but there are other reasons to do it?
I always take heart in the fact that Voltaire described Canada as a few acres of snow and rock. because he was like, we got problems at home and we've got all this culture here. And why would we worry ourselves with something that is so far away that has unproven capability? And let's just stick to our knitting. And you know, do we really have to invent anything new? You know, that's not human nature. I have a 10-month-old granddaughter who's just learning to walk. I find it fascinating that she is learning to walk through evolution far earlier than she learns to talk. We have to go explore to learn how things work. It's absolutely fundamental to how we develop and who we are. And so that's not going to go away. So you have to roll that into our natural behavior and what we're going to do. And when you give people a barely attainable goal, I mean, no one would break world records if we didn't have the Olympics, or at least all of that build up to the Olympics. It brings out the absolute maximum of human performance. You need those inspirational, barely attainable things in society so that people attempt the impossible. And there's lots of that going on in medicine and in scientific research and other things in art on Earth. But it's also, to some part of the population, hugely inspirational to try and understand and explore the rest of the universe. And the fact that that's happening right now with Canadian people and Canadian technology, it inspires a lot of people. When I was at the Kepler launch here recently, I was just, all kinds of people I'd never met kept coming up to me and saying, hey, we haven't met, but the things that you did in your space astronaut career, they inspired me to get a university degree. They inspired me to start working in the field. That's why I'm here today. We need that within our society to inspire ourselves. And what Jeremy Hansen is doing, risking his life to be the first Canadian to ever leave Earth orbit and go around the moon, what Kepler's doing to build technology that we've never had that is enabling the world and Canada, that inspires young Canadians and helps them then push themselves and do things that we need nationally.
I mean, as one of Canada's most famous astronauts, people may well know your story, but I know from having talked to you in detail about how you came to decide to be an astronaut, that it really shaped your childhood. It shaped decisions that you made along the way. Some of that, it's hard not to say, Chris, there's an innate quality in you because you're here. You're a successful retired astronaut. You've had all of the honors you could hope for in that field, but you're also a musician. Then you decide to write books, including fiction and including multiple genres of fiction, which become bestsellers, which means they're not bad. They're good. They're not selling because you're who you are. People actually want to read them. So I guess I'm not just complimenting you. It's a roundabout way of saying, I think there's a special brew of a kind of person who does what you do. So for people who think, oh, maybe I'll be an astronaut, is there kind of an innately sort of polymath sort of aspect to the people who can do this well?
Well, I think specialization, it's not me who made up this quote. It was one of the science fiction authors, maybe Heinlein, said specialization is for insects. We're people. We should be multifaceted. And you should be constantly reinventing and challenging yourself. You know, if you're no longer learning and growing, then what are you doing? You're either steady or decreasing. And why not continue to challenge yourself? But on the other side of that, man, my only real goal I set myself when I was a kid, I wanted to walk on the moon. I'm not going to walk on the moon. By definition, I'm a failure. I didn't do the one thing I set out to do, but I don't consider myself a failure. And it's the dream of doing that impossible thing that has given me the impetus and then the slowly increasing skill set to try a lot of other things. And what I counsel young people all the time is you're like riding up a succession of elevators in your life or staircases, and you're going to have to get off at one of the floors. You're probably not going to make it all the way to the top of the CN Tower, whatever it is you define for your life. You're going to have to get off at one of the floors. But if you don't have that end game in mind, then what's going to keep challenging you to summon the effort necessary to climb each one of those flights of stairs? But make sure that every single flight of stairs that you climb in your life is getting you to a floor that you want to be on. And then if you get off at that floor, like I was an engineer first, like that's a great job, and I would love to be an engineer. I was a combat fighter pilot. I was a test pilot. I was a downhill ski racer, not good enough to be national team or anything, but all those things I was doing, they were fascinating and challenging, and I would have loved to do them for life, but they were also, in an indirect way, leading me towards things I hoped I would eventually be able to get to do. But boy, just enjoy the stuff you're doing. Love the challenge of life. Always be trying to learn new things. And it's amazing what could happen in just one lifetime. And hopefully, I'm not done yet.
No. You're definitely not done yet. You're both young and obviously prolific. And by the way, I didn't say musician who still plays with your band at events. So not everybody knows you played for the International Space Station, but you actually play for people who want to hear you in real life. I want to ask you, you know, you described that kid, and I've always been impressed. It's always stayed in my head that young Chris decided on this and then made a series of decisions that had to add up to that, which is it's fascinating. Do young kids in Canada have the same shot? In other words, is our education system holding up? Are the opportunities still in front of them in the way that it was, you know, I want to say in our generation? Are we doing enough to support the potential of young people?
We're never doing as much as we could. For a long time, we've done enough because we have so many great examples of Canadian products, of our society, of our culture, of our economic and educational system. What I'm lucky enough to do as an astronaut is regularly interface with kids in school and to go and visit with a classroom virtually or in person. And I find it so immensely refreshing. It's easy to convince yourself that, oh, you know, the good old days and kids these days. People begin saying kids these days for thousands of years. The young people that I speak with, the ones that I work with working through the Creative Destruction Lab, they have that exact same burning necessity to get stuff done and to learn and to push the edge of technology and make the most of who they are. And it's not for everybody. But there's a subset of us who it's obviously very much for. But it takes work. That's why we have government, and it's why we have laws, and why we try and build a thing that is called Canada to give as many of our young people opportunity as possible. And we're far from perfect, but look around the world. I mean, look what Russia's doing to the Ukraine right now. Look what's happening in Iran right now. Look what's happening in a lot of places in the world. We're immensely lucky and ahead of the pack in Canada because of the generations of hard work that went before us. And so, yeah, you can gripe about, oh, and I'm not blaming you. I'm just saying people can gripe about, oh, it's terrible or it should be better or whatever, compared to what exactly? And don't just complain about it. If you think there's something imperfect, then go do something about it. Go volunteer at a school, go teach, write a book, go do something, you know, and try and make it better. If you can even make it better for one other Canadian, then you're not just a critic, you're actually part of the solution. And so to me, I think we're doing way better than average in the world, and we have tremendous opportunity, and the evidence of that is right here in front of us.
I'm going to leave it on that note because it's a good one. And thank you for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Lovely to talk with you. And go Jeremy Hansen. The moon is yours, man.
We've been speaking with Chris Hadfield. Before you go, here are three things we think are worth watching this week. Mark Carney's address at Davos is one for the record books, marking a decisive moment in the move to a new world order. It's no secret that Canada is and must adjust to the reality of a very changed America. What remains to be seen is whether the other middle powers in Europe and elsewhere jump on board. Meanwhile, there was another stark warning from the head of Anthropic, one of the main contenders in the AI race. They're warning that the world may be headed for a dystopian future with a few million with wealth and most others suffering. That was the good news. Just kidding. Dario Amodei is also excited about the potential for AI, but says more attention should be paid to the harms. Closer to home, Canadian waste management firm GFL says it's moving its headquarters to Miami to better appeal to U.S. investors. Its founder, CEO, already has a house there, and while it does a lot of business in the U.S., coming as President Trump persists in his claim on Greenland and even Canada, it's hard not to feel that the timing of this announcement stinks. That's Wonk for this week. I'm Amanda Lang. Thanks for being with us.